Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome back to Dark Poutine. I am Captain Michael C. Brown, captain of the USS Dark Poutine. Across from me is my science officer, Matthew Stockton.
Greetings, Earthlings.
Greetings. Do you have your Spock ears on?
I don't.
Are you a Star Trek fan?
Not really.
Not really? There's a new one.
My husband's obsessed.
Ah.
I have this joke. My first 5 years walking in the house, mm-hmm. All I'd hear from the TV is, Khan! He loves Wrath of Khan.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
No, it's not.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during the Dark Poutine podcast are solely those of the producer and do not necessarily represent those of Curious Cast, its affiliate, Global News, nor their parent company, Chorus Entertainment.
Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish. Our content is often intense, and some listeners may find it disturbing. We are not experts on the topics we present, nor are we journalists. We are ordinary Canadian schmucks chatting about crime and the dark side of history. Let's get to it. Put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double and a Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some Dark Poutine.
So this week, in part two of our series on UFOs, we're going off the Dark Poutine beaten path a bit. First, we'll hear two parts of the interview I did with Chris Rutkowski, scientist and the ufologist responsible to collect reports of UFOs from Canadians in Canada. He uses that data for the Canadian UFO report, which he publishes annually. As well, we had so many replies to my call for UFO stories from so many interesting folks. In a bonus episode that you will see in our feed, we will hear from listeners talking about their own experiences with possible UFOs. Included in those is a tape of Ken Bunn of Saskatchewan, who recorded his own late 1960s sighting for his grandchildren in the 1990s. His daughter-in-law, Petra, also a friend of the show, shared the tape with us. And at the end of the bonus episode, you'll hear Matthew and I talk about our recent experience traveling to Area 51. Let's get to it, though. Here's Chris Rutkowski to tell us about himself and what he does. I just want to welcome you to Dark Poutine for our very special series of episodes on UFOs, UAPs. Can you give us a brief breakdown about who you are and what it is that you do in regard to UFOs?
Well, my name is Chris Rutkowski. I am a science writer, and I have been writing extensively about UFOs and related phenomena since about the late 1970s. I've actually investigated cases. I've talked to pilots, air traffic control operators, RCMP, good observers, people who should know what's in the sky, and have traveled extensively across Canada to visit places where UFOs have been seen. My background is that I have degrees in science and in education, specializing in science education. I like to tell people about some of the interesting science discoveries and some of the world-shattering discoveries that are always going on, and to sort of appreciate the universe and our own backyard. I think it's great to help kids look in wonder at the rings of Saturn, or just to really appreciate some of the science that's really all around us. So that's what I'm interested in. And when I was in university, I was interested in space. I grew up watching the Apollo missions. I remember my parents making me sit down as a very young kid and watch the Mercury and Gemini launches and things like that on TV, on a black and white fuzzy TV. I just had the space bug. It was kind of cool. And I was in university, and calls started coming into the astronomy department from people who said that they had seen UFOs, and my profs were not all that interested in UFOs because to them, UFOs were nonsense.
Right.
But I thought, well, I'll take the calls for you if you don't want to. And I'm trying to get on their good side, So I ended up talking with people and was quite fascinated with what I had heard, because I was told that there's nothing to UFOs. And yet here are these people they're not trying to pull the wool over my eyes. They don't seem to be making things up. They just have seen something they didn't understand and were looking to me to try and put it in perspective. So over the years, I started talking to more people. I was actually asked to lecture about it at university. I wrote some books. And before you know it, I was kind of the UFO guy. And that's where it is right now.
You've kind of become the go-to UFO guy here in Canada, which is really kind of cool. That's why I'm so happy that you could be on the show.
Well, glad to be here. Glad I can help to talk about some of this stuff.
So recently, there's been a little bit of activity going on in the media about UFOs and UAPs, and it kind of started ramping up around the time that videos were released that were taken by pilots from the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz of some strange, very fast-moving and oddly behaving objects in the sky. Those videos have been viewed millions of times, and there are a lot of theories as to what they might be. Other than some sort of hypersonic weapon that we had not been aware of up until recently, what are your thoughts on those videos?
Well, the videos are curious. They sometimes come with an audio track which doesn't match what you're actually seeing on the screen, so there's some issues there. We don't have the full set of videos. We know that two of the videos are actually from the same event, but they've been cut in two and things edited out. So there's some issues there about how come we don't have the full documentation. The eyewitness testimony from some of the pilots involved is quite riveting. There's no question of that. But at the same time, they're not absolute proof. I mean, they seem to be moving in strange ways, but some could be, just an optical phenomenon, an artifact of what we're looking at on these night vision and other resolution devices. It is no question that there's something strange going on. Mm-hmm. There's something also strange in that, according to the pilots, these UAPs had been observed for weeks before these videos were taken. And the question that arises for me is, well, why didn't you do something about it then? Like, why would the United States Navy not do anything about incursions into a training area until 2 weeks later? Like, to me, it doesn't really make much sense. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of questions. And it is true that if what we are hearing from the pilots and what is being told we're seeing on the screen are completely accurate, then it does seem that there's something not of our technology, and that, you know, that we can't explain as what we're seeing. But at the same time, you know, there's some possibility that this was these videos were taken in some cases on a training area or in a training area where you know, there had been tests of drones, there had been tests of other technology. And it's also strange, how come this is the United States Navy? How come we haven't heard anything from the United States Air Force mm-hmm. on this exact same situation too? So there's a lot of questions. And I think my, rather than embracing all of it and just saying, yeah, absolutely, this is proof that aliens are here, I just say, well, let's sit back and look at the evidence a little more coldly and try and get more information as to what's going on. I'm not doubting the pilot's testimony. I'm just saying, okay, but at the same time, we do know that pilots make misidentifications. We have lots of examples of that for decades. So let's know more about what's going on before we can say that this is definitely aliens.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I kind of stop short too. I don't want to ever ask you, do you think these are creatures from another planet? Because I know that you tend toward a bit of healthy skepticism around this kind of thing. Can you sort of give people what your thoughts are on extraterrestrial life?
Sure. I mean, I've been labeled a skeptic by believers, but at the same time, skeptics think I'm too much of a believer for even entertaining some of these thoughts. You should hear what some of the debunkers say about me. So it's interesting. I seem to be sitting on the fence, and there's no question that the pointy parts are very, very uncomfortable. And yet it's the only way that a scientist can actually regard this sort of stuff. You have to gather the information, gather the data, and then evaluate it from a number of different perspectives, because we simply don't have enough information in some cases. And because of that, we have to seem to be, looking at things with a jaundiced eye, simply because, you know, there are a lot of explanations. We do know that something like, you know, 1 or 2 or 5% of all UFO reports each year are the ones that have, no easy explanation. The rest are insufficient information, have possible explanations or definitive explanations. So, overall, you know, most UFO sightings do tend to have explanations, or we don't have enough information about them. So it is good to, you know, sit back and say, let's look at this very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to start the whole idea about conspiracy, but both the U.S. government and the Canadian government aren't quite as transparent as they could be about these things. And the U.S., for example, has gone really far down a rabbit hole as far as, like, let's debunk as much as this stuff as we possibly can, calling it weather balloons and swamp gas and all that kind of thing. In some cases, it may have been exactly those things. However, I think the attitude, and probably for reasons of national security in both cases, that their level of, well, we can talk about this, but we can't talk about that, leads people to believe in more conspiratorial things.
Yeah, and as far as transparency goes, believe it or not, Canada is much more transparent than the United States. In fact, the United States, its famous Project Blue Book, was finished in 1969, a little bit into 1970 for a few cases. And after that point, we really have no information on what was being done regarding UFOs until relatively recently, when it was discovered that there had been a program looking into UAP or UFOs from 2007 to 2012. But there's a pretty big gap there. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Canada, we have a fairly consistent record of UFOs that have been reported through government agencies, originally from the Royal Canadian Air Force, then to the National Research Council of Canada, and in conjunction with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and more recently with Transport Canada, which is the Canadian equivalent of the FAA, we have reports going through this entire period. And even just over the past 20 years or so, a diligent reporter named Daniel Otis got some material released that Transport Canada had, indicated that they had 500 or so separate incidents classified as UFOs. In Canada, they're called UFOs, not UAP. There are a lot of pilot reports in there, a lot of reports from air traffic controllers, some radar indications, that type of thing. That's just over the past 20 years or so. Now, what's curious is that all of those, the 500 cases, have been public knowledge. Transport Canada actually makes those public. I've had, all of those for, many years all along. There's another category of cases called surveys cases, which is communication instructions for reporting vital intelligence sightings. And those are also by pilots. In fact, pilots are required to report any unusual activity that, might indicate some security concerns. And they actually call them UFOs, that pilots are required to report UFOs. And every year, pilots do report UFOs, and we have those documents. I've had many documents. There's hundreds of documents that we've had over the past several decades that indicate something was going on. And even before that, when the National Research Council and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were investigating, there's hundreds of reports of UFOs that were filed with them and investigated in some cases. So, Canada has a better record than the United States. So it's even though, the recent discoveries and recent revelations of Canadian documents don't seem to be making a big dent in the American UFO scene, it's actually quite significant because Canada is partners with the United States on NORAD, and a lot of these cases were filed with NORAD. So, this is a quite a significant batch of documents.
Now, Daniel Otis, you mentioned him. He wrote in November 2001 that credible UFO reports are being ignored, declassified Canadian government documents reveal. And he says essentially that they have been, excuse my friend, shit-canned without real investigation. So what does the government of Canada do with these reports? Do they look into them?
That's a really good question. Up until 1995, there was some investigation, not a great deal of investigation in a lot of cases, but there were some significant investigations. That year was when the National Research Council and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police parted ways, essentially, and got out of the UFO business. But up until that point, there was a certain amount of investigation, although there's an interesting book by a historian named Matthew Hayes, who looked at what the National Research Council was actually doing with regard to UFOs. And it seems that UFOs were kind of a hot potato. Nobody really wanted to have anything to do with them. In the United States, UFOs were viewed more as a security threat, whereas in Canada, they were more of a scientific issue. And the scientists themselves didn't really, have a lot of interest in UFOs. They thought people were just misidentifying things and or making things up. So it really got bounced around, and after about 1995, when they were transferred over to Transport Canada and other organizations, nobody seemed to know what to do with them. Now, what's interesting is that in the 1990s, I was working on a number of astronomical research issues, and I was in Ottawa at the National Research Council and had lunch and coffee with some of the scientists at the National Research Council, and they're bemoaning the fact that there's these UFO reports that still come into them, and that they're getting tired of it. They would like to wash their hands of the whole UFO thing. And I just said, well, you can always give them to me. I mean, I'm curious about what people are seeing. And they said, really? I said, yeah, sure. And that was the last I heard of it until the year 2000, when I started getting UFO reports that people were filing with the Canadian government. And I kind of became the civilian arm of the Canadian government's UFO team. And have been making a lot of these documents public through the Canadian UFO survey that I publish every year, posting them in various forums on blogs, and more recently on Facebook and Twitter and places like that. I'm also getting close to retirement, and I was actually approached by the University of Manitoba to donate my collection of UFO files and materials. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I hadn't really thought about where this was going to go. So I actually have donated most of my UFO files to the University of Manitoba Archives and Special Collections Department. As a matter of fact, just today, I took over 7 large bins, plastic bins of books and files. And there's many, many more bins to go. A lot of this material is there already, and we're looking at something like 23,000 UFO reports from the past 30 years in Canada as part of the Canadian UFO Survey. Mm. In addition, there's about another 10,000 digital copies of government UFO files. And I'm just looking across my office right now. There's probably another 5,000 to 10,000 separate documents and files on other UFO cases. And I'm working on a retrospective going back into history, into the 1940s and even earlier for cases. So, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of UFO reports all told.
So that sounds like it is a huge amount of stuff that you have. Basically on paper?
Mostly on paper, yeah.
Wow. So yeah. What does the university plan to do with it? Are they going to digitize things or?
Yeah, the purpose, the goal is eventually to digitize the whole thing. Now, of course, with a limited budget, they're going very, very slow. Mm-hmm. There are a number of digitizing programs that are going on around the world right now. In Sweden, for example, with the Archives for Ufology, and also an American researcher by the name of David Marler, plus people like Barry Greenwood and Jan Aldrich in the United States, have acquired the UFO files and materials of the Center for UFO Studies, of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, of NICAP, and other researchers' files, and they're in the process of digitizing them and archiving them. So a lot of this material is being preserved, which is really good to see. And unfortunately, my collection is going to take a little while. Stanton Friedman, the noted researcher and lecturer, after his passing, his collection was donated to the University of New Brunswick. Sorry, not the University of New Brunswick, the province of New Brunswick's archives. And it's so massive that, according to the archivist there, it's going to take 10 to 15 years to even process it, let alone digitize it. So we're talking about huge amounts of information, but the idea is that eventually it's going to be very accessible, and you know, people can have a lot of fun looking through this material.
So if you dig hard enough on like the CADORS site, CADORS, I think it's pronounced, you can find these kind of reports from pilots and all that kind of stuff. There's not a lot of detail there, but there's some really, really interesting things there.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yeah.
Has anything that you've seen really stood out to you?
Well, there are a number of cases in the Ketterer's files. There was a case that, I'm trying to think what year it was now, going back, let's say 5 years, of a Porter Airlines flight that was going from, I think, Ottawa to Toronto or the other way around. And in flight, right in their flight path, was a large donut-shaped object that shouldn't have been there that caused the pilot to take evasive action. This is a commercial airline. And doing so, some of the stewards on board were jostled around quite severely. I think one person's head hit the top of the aisle, and had to be treated when they got back to onto the ground. There was an investigation. We know that this was also investigated by the Transportation Safety Board, which is another body that's occasionally involved. And what was told was that this was not a balloon. This was not a, you know, a conventional object. This was something else, but nobody seemed to come forward with what it really was. But here's the thing. A lot of the KEDOR's reports are reported by pilots. And as I mentioned, pilots are required to file these reports. If a pilot, for example, sees a light or an object near his or her plane and reports it, or let's say it's picked up on radar, or there's a collision avoidance system that's that goes off because there's something there and there's nothing to be seen. You know, that suggests that since passengers are flying in on board these aircraft, there's a safety issue. There, you know, if there's a problem with the technology itself, the radars on the Fritz, the collision avoidance systems on the Fritz, the pilot, if there's pilot is seeing something that's not there, is it a problem with the pilot? And so, you know, there's a lot of issues involved here. And if these are occurring with such frequency, as I mentioned, 500 in the past 20 years alone, then one would think that this is worth investigating and worth studying. This, we're not even talking in terms of aliens or anything. We're just talking in terms of what is being reported in the skies. And that's just Canada. You have to multiply by a factor of 10 at least for what's being reported in the United States. So the fact that in the United States, there's a program that theoretically is going to look at UAP, methodological system, is very promising, but it's something that's very much needed.
Is that what's coming as far as the announcement that the United States House Intelligence Committee is hearing testimony next week from two Pentagon officials? Is that kind of the word on the street?
It's related to that. There was this UAP task force report which came out last year that everybody got pretty excited about, and that was the one that said that there were 143 or 144 cases that didn't have an explanation, and those were seen by pilots, mostly military pilots, and all during a very short period of time. I think they only went back 18 months or 24 months or something like that, and all near military installations. So what is misleading is it's not that these 144 or 143 couldn't be explained and were unexplained completely. Mm-hmm. What was actually said in the report is that they had no definitive explanation for them because there was insufficient information. So only one was actually explained, and they were able to say that this UAP which was reported turned out to be a deflating balloon. All the rest didn't have enough information to pin down exactly what they were. In other words, they had possible explanations as drones and balloons and other planes and so forth, but they needed more information in order to determine exactly which ones they were. That's very different from saying that they had no explanation. Mm-hmm. I think what's going to be happening on the 17th of May, this congressional hearing, is that there will be some testimony. There's an open hearing, which is actually going to be broadcast live on congressional TV, I understand. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be a classified briefing. And it's hard to tell what's going to be said in the unclassified. We probably will find out something about the classified briefing at one point after people file Freedom of Information requests. But what we have to remember is that this is not new. People are saying this is fantastic. The gates are being thrown wide open, and hooray for all the big pushes from some of the people who've been working on this. Well, Gerald Ford, before he was president, lobbied for an official congressional investigation into UFOs back in 1966. And there was a series of congressional hearings in 1968, at which the scientists like Carl Sagan and Alan Hynek gave testimony about what they thought was going on in the UFO field. So that was 1968. 1969, Project Blue Book was shut down because there was not sufficient evidence that it was worth, any scientific analysis. And after that point, it's a big black hole. We don't know exactly what was going on in the United States with regard to UFOs. So the last time there were congressional hearings, it shut down UFO investigations. Mm-hmm. So what's going to happen this time around? I have no idea. I think people shouldn't get their expectations too high. It's interesting, and it's going to be, curious to see what does come out of it. But it's happened before.
Thanks, Chris, and we'll take a break right here so some of our listeners can hear from our sponsors.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
For the first part of this episode, we didn't hear from you, Matthew, obviously, because it is part one of my interview with Chris Rutkowski, the ufologist.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a super fascinating guy.
Yeah.
Really nice. Good sense of humor.
He's been doing this for a while.
This for a really long time.
That's great.
So let's forge forth and get into part two of our interview with Chris Rutkowski. Does Canada need a centralized organization that is looking at these things? I mean, you're retiring, so, are you retiring from collecting the reports as well? Is that what's going on?
No, I'm not going to retire from ufology necessarily. I'm going to retire from some of the activities, but certainly not from that. There's still so much to cover. I think Canada does need to have some sort of committee struck to investigate UAPs and UFOs in a little more rigorous fashion. I've made this point a number of times over the past more than 20 years now that there should be a coordinated effort. Right now, it does look like Transport Canada is receiving things but not investigating. There's another body called NAV Canada, which is actually a non-governmental branch, which is exempt from access to information requests, that appears to be, in a better position. They do receive these UAP and UFO reports, and we suspect may be in doing some investigating too, but they're under no obligation to release any of that information, whereas we do get the Transport Canada reports. So I suspect there should be a more coordinated effort. We do know that some Canadian politicians have spoken out about trying to get more information. An MP named Larry Maguire has already given a presentation and asked questions in a Canadian parliamentary committee regarding the release of information about UAP in Canada. And that at least one or two other politicians said, yes, we definitely want to hear more about this. I've, in addition to myself giving a briefing to the Canadian Minister of National Defense last year, I've also briefed Mr. Maguire and a few other politicians who have asked about what's going on with Canadian ufology. So I think at a political level, there is a desire to find out more information. Part of this is because what's going on in the United States, that, Canada shouldn't be left out. Part of it is because Canada is partners with NORAD, and it makes perfect sense for the Canadian Minister of National Defense to have been briefed on what's going on, because, chances are that briefing would have carried over into the American side of NORAD, and perhaps the Secretary of Defense in the United States was similarly briefed. So I suspect there's a lot more going on, but even the fact that the Canadian Minister of National Defense was briefed on UFOs is very significant, because we don't have any information that the Secretary of Defense in the United States has ever been briefed in this manner. So I think, again, Canada seems to be ahead of what's going on in the United States, even though people are saying that Canada is dragging its feet and hasn't done anything. You know, it's a very complicated issue depending on, you know, which side you take a look at.
Yeah, for sure. And we have investigated things before, and Canada has put money toward things before. And one thing I kind of omitted from our questions, but I know you know a little bit about, in the last episode, I spoke about W.B. Smith and Project Magnet. Mm-hmm. That to me was super fascinating. I mean, whether or not he was investigating a technology that was extraterrestrial or not is irrelevant to me, because I think what they were doing was really fascinating. What do you feel that was the, of course, the car alarm's going off right now. Yeah. What do you feel, what if anything, have you learned that sort of expands on Project Magnet after its official close? Was there anything that you can talk about there?
I mentioned some work by Matthew Hayes, Search for the Unknown. He looked very deeply at what the National Research Council was doing with regard to UFOs, and what the Royal Canadian Air Force had been doing. And he delves into Wilbert Smith in some detail. It's a lot less positive than a lot of people have heard. As a matter of fact, I go into it a little bit more. My next book is coming out in a few weeks, called Canada's UFOs Declassified, and I have sections on Wilbert Smith as well. It turns out that Smith's own director was not that impressed. In fact, Smith was a bit of an embarrassment to the department. In fact, they didn't give any money to Smith. They gave him some cast-off equipment for putting in this UFO detection station just outside of Ottawa. And while Smith was actually studying the magnetic fields as a way of propelling vehicles, studying the Earth's magnetic field, he believed that himself personally, that flying saucers had something to do with magnetic fields. Mm-hmm. And so that's how he got involved in that. There was another project, Project Second Story, which was sort of almost concurrent with this, where there were a number of people at Defense and also at the National Research Council who were on board. Not necessarily the National Research Council, but Defense Research Board and so forth, who were curious about the UFO problem, again, because the Americans were looking into it. And they looked very, very cursorily at it. There is not a very half-hearted attempt. Wilbert Smith himself was absolutely convinced that there was something to this. But he kind of went overboard to the point where he believed that he was telepathically communicating with aliens. Mm-hmm. He was heavily involved with the Ottawa Flying Saucer Club, which was very heavily into what we describe now as contactees, and a lot of really way out concepts that, again, were to the embarrassment of his colleagues at within the defense and communications community. So it's a really big problem. There's no question that he was a prominent figure. Mm-hmm. And even things like where he, you know, said that he went to Washington and had made some discreet inquiries and found out that issue of flying saucers is rated two levels higher in terms of secrecy than the H-bomb. You have to think, why would anybody even tell a low-level communications administrator person this if that's true? It just doesn't ring right when you look at that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people believe that Wilbert Smith, you know, was trying to, you know, pioneer this field and that he was fighting the good fight. Although the evidence seems to go against this, who knows? It's an interesting snippet of Canadian history, that's for sure.
You mentioned your book, your new book that's coming out. You've had a few others, but Canada's UFOs Declassified. Can you talk to us about that book a little more?
Sure. I looked at the various UFO files that are called the NRC UFO files, but actually come from the Royal Canadian Air Force and the RCMP and so forth, covering a period from about 1947 to about 1970, or was it 81? I think I might go a little bit further than that. But 9,000 or so UFO files have been digitized by the Library and Archives Canada in Ottawa. That's where the National Research Council was sending their UFO files every year. Every year, there was this office in the National Research Council in the Hertzberg Institute of Astrophysics. And there was one person who was answering phones from people who were reporting UFOs to taking teletypes off the teletype machine and opening letters and snail mail, that type of thing, and filing them in a filing cabinet in this one room within the Hertzberg Institute of Astrophysics. At the end of the year, everything from that year was taken to Library and Archives Canada for processing, and then it was put into the archives for people to look at. And I made the trip to Ottawa many times. I actually was at the Hertzberg Institute of Astrophysics quite a few times. And eventually, you know, there'd been such demand, and because of the interest in the phenomenon, Library and Archives Canada decided that it was going to digitize some of these documents. Now, not all of them have been digitized. There's still a significant portion which aren't. But even so, there are about 9,000 separate documents representing something like 2,500 to 3,000 separate UFO reports are part of this this large file. And I went through that batch of reports to pick out the more interesting ones, and the ones that are very strange, like RCMP officers who report that disc-shaped objects buzz their car, pilots reporting close encounters and where their Hyper Cub airplane was actually levitated in flight by a UFO.
Oh dear.
Things like that, that you know, you sort of think, well, this is pretty strange, and how come we never heard of these before? And yet they're in the files. Mm-hmm. Some of them were investigated extensively. And in fact, people are saying, you know, Canada has never really done an investigation into UFOs. Well, there's several cases where investigations were very, very thorough. Falcon Lake, Shag Harbor, I know you've talked about those before. Mm-hmm. My collection of papers on the Falcon Lake case alone, hundreds of pages of documentation, including the interrogation and testimony of witnesses and the family and other people involved, where members of the Royal Canadian Air Force and the RCMP visited the site, took samples, and the samples were analyzed and found to be radioactive. And, you know, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, that was a very thorough investigation. And Shag Harper seems also to have some documentation, although certainly nowhere near as many.
Right.
And there are several cases in the National Research Council UFO files that are of that caliber.
Wow.
Where some very strange things were documented in great detail.
Well, better you than me, because I've looked through that the Libraries and Archives Canada site with four things that are tagged UFO. Mm-hmm. And some of them, like you say, are snail mail letters that, you know, Grandma Smith wrote in about, I saw a light in the sky, and this is the light that I saw and while I was baking a pie, essentially, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to sort through all that stuff to create a cohesive book with interesting stories?
Well, I'm hoping it's cohesive. That remains to be seen.
Yeah, it will be.
Oh, yeah, it took many, many years. And some of it is drawn directly from the National Research Council files. Some of it's from additional files. There's actually FBI files that were included as well. So it's quite a lot of research that went into this. I wanted to make sure I documented things. The other interesting thing about this book that I wanted to do is actually provide the actual documents and case files. So I would say, I can't remember the actual number. I know we added more at the last minute. There could be maybe 50 or 60 pages of official documents that we're reproducing so that anyone reading the book can actually see what was being said and the cases described. So it's fairly unique, and it covers, again, just a matter of 40 years or so. And I, you know, I have a lot more material to come. So, you know, there may be another book in the offing.
That's great. I mean, I, for one, am really excited to read it. I've always find it interesting that year 1947, that things kind of started to happen then, and that's the year of Roswell. That's just an aside, but it's kind of interesting. I wonder how much the Roswell incident informed UFO sightings and what actually took place after.
Well, I can actually tell you that one of my projects is sort of a documenting a historical set of UFO cases in Canada. And they go back much earlier than 1947. Yeah. In fact, official reports go back much further than that. So it's not a magical number at all, a magical year at all. There were cases previous to that. But that was a year that it just seemed to capture people's imagination. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one interesting thing about the UFO phenomenon. It's something that everybody has an opinion about, whether they've read enough about it or not, but it's the type of thing where you can be sitting at a family gathering or at a bar or at a party. You mention UFOs and almost everyone will say, you know, I didn't see anything myself, but my uncle said that, you know, sure. saw something yeah. the other day. It's something that really touches everybody. And, you know, as humans, we've always looked up into the sky, wondering if we're alone in the universe. Now, with my background in astronomy, I share the belief that there probably is out there somewhere extraterrestrial civilization, on a planet orbiting a star, who knows how many light years away. And the problem is it's just tough to travel between the stars.
Sure.
But because our sun is an average star, that means that there are some that are older and some that are younger. And if there's a star a little bit older than our sun, maybe a planet much like the Earth has a bit of a head start on us, and maybe they're a little more advanced technologically. And I'm not talking 100 years or 1,000 years, but you know, there are the possibilities that the planets around nearby stars are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years more advanced than ours. And while we can't break the laws of physics to travel between the stars, maybe if somebody on one of those planets has figured out a way to bend the laws of physics mm-hmm. to travel. And that's quite exciting. But we don't have any proof. All the speculation in the world that these little odd white and dark things that we see on the videos of the Nimitz and the FLIR and the GoFasts and sure. Those things, they're not proof that we're being visited. But the possibility is there, and the possibility is never zero, or the probability is never zero. And it's exciting that we live in the James Cameron universe or the yeah. Steven Spielberg universe, where aliens are very common to be on the silver screen or on TV. And, is there somebody out there who's going to save us from wars and pandemics? Maybe somebody has figured out a way around that without the destruction of that civilization. If so, I'm all ears.
You mentioned Steven Spielberg and James Cameron. Do you think that the attention brought to these things by media like that, do you think it hurts the scientific conversation and has people looking perhaps with a little more bias at the situation, say, oh, it's that Steven Spielberg stuff. This isn't what we really should be looking at. So let's look the other way.
Well, again, we have to go back quite a few years. This isn't new. In the 1940s and 1950s, there was a whole series of flying saucer movies, mm-hmm. Flying Saucers from Mars and The Flying Saucer and things like that. Spaceship Earth, some classics. So there was always media. In fact, one has to go back into the 80s and 90s for the X-Files. And people have said that, the X-Files were going to cause people to see UFOs. Well, actually, the number of UFOs, really didn't take off, pardon the pun, with the X-Files. And it was after that, during the advent of the internet, that people started reporting UFOs in greater and greater numbers. Now, because it was so easy to report because of the internet, that's certainly possible. But there's been a steadily increasing number of UFO reports every year in Canada and reflected elsewhere around the world. Up until about 2015 or so, and then the numbers started to decline a little bit with a couple of bumps. We do know that 2020 had one of the highest numbers of UFO reports in a single year. I think it was the third highest or second highest.
Wow.
I'm giving you the scoop that we've just released our Canadian UFO survey for 2021. And there's only about 700 UFO cases in 2021, a significant drop from the year before. Not entirely sure why.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because, with all this attention, you would think things would be ramping up, but they don't seem to be.
Well, there's a vast difference between attention and interest in UFOs and the actual reporting of a UFO by somebody. Mm-hmm. I think, people are all excited and they want to watch as many videos and TV shows as possible. And read as many Facebook posts and
sure.
and Instagram posts? And is there something on TikTok that I should be watching too? And yet without the actual reports, all this information and speculation and the excitement and TV shows really aren't that important, because the foundation of every speculation on whether the aliens are here or there, or from which planet they're from and how they're being propelled and why they're this shape and not that shape, it's all based on the reports. And if you don't have the reports, you don't have the data. Mm-hmm. And without the data, we don't have much of ufology at all. So the number of UFO reports that are actually filed seems to have started going down. Maybe the assumption is that now that the United States has this task force, we'll leave it to them to do all the hard work and an investigation. And, you know, they've got it all wrapped up. They'll tell us what's really going on. And yet, without the average person reporting UFOs, we don't have much. Mm-hmm. And that's the concern, because the United States task force, as we mentioned, only looked at military and pilot reports. If you, for example, wanted to make a report to that task force, how would you go about it? Would they even be interested? And even the Galileo project, this new project by Avi Loeb, the Harvard astronomer, who's gathered a bunch of scientists to look into the subject of UAP, he's made no secret of the fact that the ordinary person's report about UFOs isn't all that interested. They're looking only at instrumented observations like radar, cameras, videos, and so forth that can be verified. And they're coming up with a way of getting detection stations in a number of arrays so you can follow UFOs as they travel across the country. The average eyewitness report doesn't seem to fall into any of those categories. And yet, we do know that train spotting and plane spotting has been the way that a lot of information has given to and obtained by security and intelligence personnel. It's the way that we understand what's going on. In fact, in the early days of ufology in the 1940s, at the same time that Roswell was said to be occurring, there were flying saucer watch parties going on in cities and towns across North America and around the world by people with binoculars and just sitting out, you know, in lawn chairs, looking up in the middle of July, keeping track of what was going on. And when Sputnik went into space in the late 1950s, civilian observers were the ones who helped aeronautical engineers track and come up with the orbit of the Russian spacecraft. So civilian observations are very, very important. And I'm hoping that the Galileo Project and the UAP Task Force and this new, I can't even remember the AOISG or whatever it is, that it seems to be the new acronym for the United States investigation into phenomena. You know, hopefully that they're going to come up with a methodology that includes eyewitness reports as well as instrumented reports.
You put out the Canadian UFO survey, and can you tell us a little bit about that, how long you've been doing it, and what exactly it is?
Well, in the late 1980s, I wanted to know exactly what people were seeing. I was used to getting the UFO schmags on the newsstand. This was before the internet. We were getting newsletters and fanzines and UFO zines and things that made it into the National Enquirer and the occasional report on TV. But I wanted to know how common what UFOs were. I was corresponding with my colleagues across the country. So I said, can we coordinate on this? Can we just, you know, gather all the cases in 1 year and see what the distribution is like? So there's a handful of us across the country. Everybody agreed to contribute cases. And we found out that the first year, there's a little under 150 UFO reports in Canada that particular year. The next year, there was a little bit more. And the year after that, and the year after that, and the network started expanding. And we found that, you know, there were certain patterns, distributions between provinces, that the higher the population, the more UFOs were being reported. Mm-hmm. That colors and shapes and duration and times of day I know there were certain patterns regarding those as well. And over the years, and we collected quite a lot of data. I think we have something like 23,000 separate UFO reports now since we began doing this in 1989, all largely due to the generosity of a lot of other researchers across Canada who are contributing. More recently, we're data mining a lot of websites and files from other researchers and other groups. And it does seem that the distributions seem to be holding true. There are changes with time, but you know, it gives us a snapshot of what is actually being seen in a given year. And what's curious is that this 23,000 number of cases over the past 30 years or so is much larger than the number of cases that were actually in Project Blue Book. And I think we have a good database that can be mined for, you know, information for future ufological research, whether somebody's a believer or a debunker. There's some information in there about what people really were seeing in Canada, and one can make some assumptions and interpretations of the data.
That's awesome. I know you have a refreshed website, CanadianUFOReport.com, and it looks fantastic. People can find you on Twitter, all of those kind of things. What's the easiest way to get in touch with you and tell you that I've had a UFO encounter?
Sure. That's a good question. In fact, on my blog, which is euforum.blogspot.com, I have a recent post there. I think it's maybe a month or two ago. Where do you report a UFO? In fact, there's not an easy answer of where do you report a UFO? And I give some links and some ideas about where UFOs can be reported, not just in Canada, but elsewhere around the world. There's a variety of places. It's true. I have that blog, the survey website itself. We, as I mentioned, just been, we had to get a complete redesign because of the IP was getting changed. Plus, I'm on Facebook. There's a Facebook group called UFO Updates, which is the Facebook extension of a discussion forum, which was begun by Errol Bruce Knapp quite a long time ago, which has been archived now going back into the 1990s. Mm. And I was asked to take over the forum after he passed a number of years ago. I'm also an admin for a number of other UFO Facebook groups. I'm around.
Yeah, I know our friend Jordan from the Nighttime podcast. You've had conversations with him a lot, and he's got a forum on his website, and I thought I should do that on mine. You've got one on yours too.
As a matter of fact, his goes to us.
Oh, there you go. Perfect. So if you want to report a UFO, there are so many different ways to do it, and maybe that's the thing. Maybe the Canadian government just needs a page on their site that just says report a UFO here. Wouldn't that be cool?
Well, when in the briefing to the Minister of National Defense, they did actually name me to my photo with one of the slides that was presented to the minister that stated very explicitly that the UFO reports were being given to me. And, you know, I'm honored and it's a privilege. And I think that's probably why they entrusted these reports to me. It's something I'm doing as my civic duty, I suppose, because I think these are reports from people, Canadian citizens, who have had experiences that they can't explain and want some answers. Mm. And while I may not have the answers and don't have the answers in a lot of cases, at least these are being recorded for posterity. Mm-hmm. And I'm respecting their rights in that sense.
So there's a big buzzword I kind of want to leave us with. And it's the word disclosure. And I know you've probably heard that lots of times, and that's the believer's buzzword. Mm. People who use that word are the ones who think that the government is covering things up and that there are things that we should be told. What are your thoughts on disclosure?
Well, I don't think there really is any disclosure or need for disclosure. And I have to explain that. Whether you believe in disclosure with a capital D or a small D, or even something that's being called soft disclosure, which is the gradual release of information. Some people said, well, you know, the movies we're seeing on TV and the news reports we're seeing, well, that's part of soft disclosure. Well, no, it's not. What it is that dedicated researchers like Daniel Otis and Matthew Hayes and others have been very diligent at finding documents. Some are come without finding them whatsoever. In fact, the vast majority of the 300 documents that Daniel got in this last batch from the Canadian government had already been made public. So there was no disclosure at all. And yet even that was called disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And disclosure also implies that somebody is in charge sort of turning the tap on and off and coordinating it. And I think what we found from my studies and studies by Matthew Hayes and others is that the government organizations themselves may not have had any real background or knowledge about what to do with the UFO situation. They were passing it from one another like a hot potato. I suspect that was the case in the United States as well, and certainly in other countries. So I don't think that there's a coordinated effort by any organization, government, or clandestine institution that is keeping things from us that eventually is going to give us the big reveal. And that's the whole idea behind this disclosure, right?
Right.
They're going to suddenly say, okay, you're right, we have the little green guys in pickle jars, or mm-hmm. you know, we've been in contact with the aliens from Proxima Centauri for all these years. We've been working with them on underground bases. They've given us the cure for cancer and all that sort of stuff. That's behind this whole disclosure idea. And I don't think that that's the case at all.
Right.
Are there documents and UFO reports that are still secret and will always be secret? Yes, because there are certainly UFO reports that are sightings by military personnel in, I don't know, a theater of war, which you're never going to find released.
Sure.
Maybe people working undercover, you know, in intelligence operations. You know, there are going to be cases like that. So I think that there is a level of secrecy which people simply have to accept. And even in the case of what I have, in terms of, I don't know, 400 or 500 reports from the past 20 years or so through various government agencies, most of them are lights in the sky that turn out to be Starlink satellites or balloons or stars or planets or whatever. There's not really a lot to disclose. And if that's our experience in Canada, I suspect that's the same in the United States. What is going on in terms of what's, you know, these videos from the Nimitz and the other aircraft carriers and other planes and other pilots, I don't know. And that's the paradox. We simply don't know enough. We don't have the information. It would be nice to get, you know, disclosure of this information. And certainly somebody leaked these reports. And
right.
whether that someone was doing it in an official capacity or really just to cause trouble, that remains to be seen.
Thank you so much, Chris Rutkowski, for coming on the show and having a conversation with me about UFOs and your involvement in reporting in Canada.
You're most welcome. And keep an eye out.
I learned so much during this interview. What are your thoughts, Matthew?
Well, you know, I think he's kind of balanced, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
In his approach. Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And I think, and that's great, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's sort of showing.
It's hard, like being the guy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
for this kind of thing, especially with the bias that people have
yeah.
against ufologists. Like, I was watching this one show that completely poo-pooed the idea of unidentified aerial phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Completely poo-pooed it, said doesn't exist. It's like, what? Are you stupid?
It's kind of silly.
No, it is silly because there are things that people haven't identified. And he's like, oh, those guys are dumb. And like,
yeah.
And this was a scientist saying this stuff.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So he just completely ignored the fact that there's been lots of reports of...
Yeah, unidentified things. We're not saying that they're alien vehicles. We are not saying that. It'd be fun if they were, and it's a fun thing to think about, like I talked to
yeah.
Chris Rutkowski about, but we're not saying that these are alien vehicles. We're just not, because we don't know.
I have a friend who met an alien.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
He asked him, he's like, how come I haven't, he's like, I haven't heard of alien abductions for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the alien said, yeah, we did that for like 50 years.
Okay.
And all we figured out was about 10% of the population likes the anal probe.
Oh no. You got me with that. Like that was a, You set me up.
I did.
You did. You're and so easy. It was a good setup.
What does the C stand for in Michael C. Brown?
Christopher.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right. It's time for voicemails. You can leave us a message at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you. Let's see who called us this week.
All right. Let's listen to our first voicemail of this week.
Hi, Mike and Matt. It's Leslie from Calgary calling. Just listened to the most recent episode of Holly Bartlett and thought I'd weigh in as a fellow blind person. I'll try to keep this brief, but I definitely think the taxi driver is more complicit than he said. Definitely, I don't generally run through fences or, climb bridges unless there's something much scarier behind me. With that said, I appreciate the way you handled the topic, and I really loved Matt's comments about, the eye rolling about how we're so inspirational. Yes, I too don't understand how the fact I can follow signs and the fact I can find the door in a public washroom without assistance is hardly, a work of magic. Anyways, I really appreciated that you kind of got that. I guess to end, I'm supposed to tell you to poop in your toque or something, but that seems mean. So how about, Matt, you go pet Steve for me.
Aww.
How about that? Okay, thanks, guys. Have a good day.
Oh, thank you so much, Leslie. That's really nice.
I love you, Leslie.
Yeah, right? honestly, I was hoping that somebody from the blind community would call in and just sort of let us know how we did, and I feel much better. I'm always a little concerned when we tackle things with people who are not us, who are not just...
Well, I just think if you just like stop and think of humans as humans,
it just doesn't... Yeah.
I have some friends who, I just know from experience that this whole sort of awe.
Yeah.
I would love to give Steve to Leslie for a day as her seeing eye dog.
Oh, no.
He would literally lead her to the nearest boat. So, Leslie, if you ever want to go on a boat ride, I'll lend you Steve.
Exactly, yeah. Steve will take you there.
I'll give him a pat for you, Leslie.
All right, here's our next voicemail.
Hello, Mike and Matthew. This is Ayla and Katie calling from Vernon, B.C. Currently, myself and my girlfriend have the COVID, so we're stuck in the house. But thankfully, we have you guys to listen to. I don't know what we'd do without you. Mike, we've been listening since day one. And Matthew, you add the perfect amount of gay spice to the pot. We love it. Anyway, take care and drop a plopper in your topper.
Oh, my gosh.
Bye.
Oh, my gosh. Drop a plopper in your topper. I love that so much. And you do bring the right amount of gay spice to the show.
Sugar is just gay salt. Gay spice. To me, gay spice would be those like multicolored sprinkles on the top of an Angel food cake.
Yeah, something with a unicorn on the bottle.
Well, I hope you got over the nasty COVID.
Yeah. Looks like they called last week, so okay. They're probably feeling much better today.
Good.
I hope so. Anyway, to you and your girlfriend, you too can go take a plopper in your topper.
That's funny.
I thought that's great.
Plopper in the topper.
A plopper in the topper. And here's our last voicemail for this episode.
Hello, Mike and Matthew. This is Kathy Smith AC from Oregon. Longtime caller, 6th or 7th. No. Oh, good Lord. one-time listener, sixth or seventh time caller. Anyways, I hope you can edit that out. If not, whatever.
I will.
I wanted to ask a question about CrimeCon. Did you feel like it was a reunion when you were meeting back up with other podcasters or fans? Because that's what it looked like from the pictures that I've been seeing from the different podcasts. Perfect. And also, second question is, how did it make you feel when people were walking up to you and talking to you like they've known you forever? And I don't mean that in a bad way. As listeners, I think we all feel like you're our friends and that we know you. And I was just wondering, did it freak you guys out? Did you like it? I was curious. Anyways, love your show and go poop in your toque. Bye.
Oh, thanks so much for calling, Kathy. And again, thank you for your donut money donation last week. As far as like reunion, oh my God, did it ever. I mean, so I haven't seen my friend. These people are my friends. Tyler from Minds of Madness, Jessica from the Asian Madness podcast, Justin and Aaron from Generation Y. I haven't seen any of those guys for 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, we sure will keep up on Facebook Messenger and stuff like that, but I haven't seen them for 3 years. So yeah, it was awesome.
I mean, it was my first time, mm-hmm. but the one thing I took out of that part of it
mm-hmm.
was a real feeling of community amongst podcasters.
There is, yeah.
And the listeners, actually.
In a big way. And it is always weird when people come up and say, oh yeah, hey, how you doing? And they're so excited. But at the same time, like, we feel like you're our friends too. I mean, yeah. Obviously, you're listening to us.
I find it really humbling, actually.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm like, honestly, if anyone came up and were a listener, I'm like, I'm truly, honestly grateful that they're listening to us.
Yeah, me too.
And we met, some people, and we drove all the way from Texas and stuff like that. It was so cool.
Yeah.
A lot of Canadians came down. People from all over the place were there.
Yeah, Milena and her mom and her sisters were there from Calgary, and yeah. I've seen Milena and her mom at three crime cons now, which is great. And I did a little draw from a couple of copies of my book, and Milena won one of the copies of my book. So I got to sign and give her a copy of my book. And that was really special. I was thinking I would like her to win anyway, because I've seen her so many times. I feel like she's earned it. But yeah, I just drew it out of my hat, and sure enough, the first name I drew was hers, which is really cool. So yes, 100%. It is awesome being able to do that. And hopefully we'll get to do that a little more. I'm thinking about some other events that we should be doing, maybe. I don't know about traveling. Money's a little tight, but whatever. We'll be doing some more stuff around here, but maybe around the West Coast. Oregon and Seattle or Washington State are not off the list of possibilities. So who knows, Kathy? We might even meet you one day.
That'd be great.
It would be very nice. That's it for this week's voicemails. Again, you can leave us one at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you. Even if it is just to say hi and to tell us to go shit in our hats. If you're stumped for what to chat with us about, a quick story is welcome. Now on to shout-outs to our new Patreon supporters and Donut Money donors. All right, first up, we have Colleen Rothschild. Now, where is Colleen from? It sounds like she's from a family of wealth. But anyway,
she's from Quibbletown, New Jersey.
Quibbletown, New Jersey.
Yeah, I guess they quibble there.
Oh, yeah, quibbly people.
Yeah.
I guess, quibbling is better than actual arguing.
Yeah, but she's there to like stop the quibbling.
Oh, so she's a...
she's kind of a peacekeeper in Quibbletown.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. A quibble moderator.
Yeah.
She moderates the quibbling. Well, there you go. Someone's got to do that. Well, thank you for moderating the quibbling, Colleen Rothschild. Thank you. Next, we have Jesse Carroll, and Jesse is from Regina, Saskatchewan.
Oh.
Yeah. Why did you say that? Why did you make that noise?
Never mind.
Okay. So Regina, Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
And what does Jessie do in Regina, Saskatchewan, Matthew?
She is trying to get the ugly brown brick building downtown taken away.
What is that? Is there an ugly brown brick building? And
yeah, there's this monstrosity that...
What is it?
It's just some building and it's horrible. But anyway, she's on a board that's trying to get it replaced.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's probably something that needs to get done.
Yeah, it's very like 60s or 70s.
Oh, no. Well, I'm very 60s and 70s as well, so aren't you? you're very 70s. I'm very 60s.
I'm very 70s.
Yeah.
Born right on this 1970.
Yeah. Yep. Well, yeah. I always tell people I was born right between the moon landing and the Manson murders.
Okay.
Yeah. So kind of funny. Let's move on to Donut Money donors. First up, we have Darian Kunz. And Darian says, thanks for all your hard work. I would love for you to guess where I'm from and what I do, as my dad also listens to your podcast and he'd get a kick. So where is Darian from, Matthew?
There's a town in Turkey.
Yes.
This is serious.
Okay.
Called Batman.
Batman.
Yeah, he's from Batman, Turkey.
So what does Darian do in Batman, Turkey?
He's a philanthropist.
Okay.
And son of
a rich...
A wealthy couple.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
and does lots of technology and things like
that. So the father who also listens to the podcast is wealthy.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we need some more donut money then. But so that's interesting. So he's a philanthropist.
/ superhero.
What's his favorite? Oh, maybe. What's his favorite cause, do you think, as far as philanthropy goes?
Fighting crime.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. Fighting crime. I guess we all have to do it at some point. That's what we're doing here with this show.
We're crime fighters.
We're not. We are so not crime fighters.
Da-da-da!
Next, we have Holy Guacamole. Jillian Symington decided that she would send us a 3-digit
Jillian,
donut money donor donation.
You.
Wow. So thank you, Jillian. She says, I sent a snazzy email. Yes, and we got that. Thank you so much. And she says, go shit in your hat, I think. I guess.
She said, I think.
She said, go shit in your hat, I guess.
Okay.
Jill. So what does Jill, where's Jillian live, number one?
Blandshire.
That doesn't sound very fun.
It's in New South Wales, Australia.
There's a place called Blandshire in New South Wales?
Blandshire.
I would really like to go to Australia. Have you ever been?
Many times.
See, you've been everywhere and I have not.
But she has an important job in Blandshire.
What's the important job?
She wears like these fantastic frocks and fascinators in her hair to make it not bland.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
So she sent a really cool thing about fire hydrants that are all dressed up and painted.
See, told you. She's anti-bland.
Yeah, right, exactly. There. She is definitely anti-bland. I'm not going to tell you where she's really from, but holy smokes. And
She is
the mom of Butters, Tater, and Snow, her dogs.
Butters, where's Butters?
Butters, Tater, and Snow.
Oh, it's a different Butters.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're very sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she says, she really wrote a really long email, but thank you so much, Jillian. And it's so fantastic to have listeners who are so enthusiastic and animal lovers to boot. I am just definitely an animal lover.
No, she's like, I think I got the perfect job for her seeing this email.
Well, interestingly, she says about her husband was in Port Coquitlam as a kid and is pretty sure he delivered flyers to the Blackman house where Bruce Blackman murdered his family.
Yeesh.
Yeah. Whoa. And he's also 80% sure he may have rented a movie to Robert Picton when he worked at Blockbuster. Oh my gosh. Well, that's, you know, connections. So what, you say you have a job for her?
Yeah, I told you.
What is that?
She keeps it Blandshire, not bland.
Not bland.
All exciting.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll just get that out then.
Oh, look at those. Look at those fire hydrants.
The fire hydrants are really cool. Anyway, thank you so much, Jillian. We really appreciate that level of support. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thanks to all our patrons and Donut Money donors, past and present, for your generosity. It helps to keep the show going. You can become a patron of Dark Poutine at patreon.com/darkpoutine. For a one-time donation, you can send us donut money via PayPal using our email address, darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. If you don't already subscribe to the show, it would mean a lot if you did. You can easily find Dark Poutine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. If you haven't gotten yours yet, my book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, is available to order via a link on the Dark Poutine website. And speaking of darkpoutine.com, please check it out for show notes and other cool stuff. We'd appreciate it if you took the time to give Dark Poutine a like or a follow on Facebook and Instagram. Most importantly, thank you for listening. And tell your friends about us. Word of mouth is a powerful thing. Thanks for being a good egg and not a bad apple. However, there's a bonus episode for you to listen to. So go to the Dark Poutine feed and check it out now.